There you go.
I just want to let you know that I was very happy that I found the right button that was mute while I was urinating.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
We don't have to edit that out, though, because you were not muted there.
All right. No, yeah, it'll all work out.
The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Brian Hartman.
That's me.
And Sean Riley.
Hello.
We are here tonight to discuss our December trio of movies with the common theme of culture clashes. They were, in order, The Big Sick, Morris from America, and Dances with Wolves. And we're just going to dive right in and start talking about The Big Sick. It's the story of Kumail Nanjiani and Emily V. Gordon's courtship, their rocky courtship. As far as the movie is concerned, it was apparently a lot smoother in real life. Nanjiani plays himself as an aspiring Chicago stand-up, juggling his modern lifestyle and his conservative Pakistani heritage. And during a potentially terminal patch of their relationship, Emily herself falls into a potentially terminal coma, and this forces Kumail to somewhat awkwardly play caretaker before Emily's parents can show up. What did you all think of this movie, of The Big Sick?
I think I may have given it an A+ when
you did, and answered it on the show. That review was greatly appreciated.
Yeah. I watched the other two, but I didn't review them.
Sure. I mean, we can only expect so much. Brian, initial thoughts, Big Sick?
I don't know if I had any complaints. I lived in Chicago for a while, so anything in Chicago always gets a little bump for me. It was good. It was really good. It's a movie that I would absolutely recommend to anybody without reservation.
As far as the setting, I don't know. I doubt it was actually filmed in Chicago. Did you notice if it was or it wasn't, like, landmarks that you recognized or didn't recognize?
They had, like, the token Chicago brownstone. Okay. But other than that, they weren't out and about very much. But
all right.
Brownstones in other places.
We did it.
Yeah, the comedy club could have been a famous Chicago comedy club, or it could have been just any comedy club in America.
Right. Yeah. As far as myself, like, I've listened to Kumail and Emily's podcast about video games, The Indoor Kids, for a very long time. Like, they stopped doing episodes about a couple years ago, but I got through their whole back catalog. And, like, if you spend that much time with someone, just as our fans have spent so much time with us, they undoubtedly feel like we're best friends. And I kind of felt that way with Kumail and Emily. So it was like watching, you know, two friends make a successful movie. Like, if Brian saw a movie made by fucking Kestenbaum from Planet Money or whatever his name is, he'd probably be like, hey, my friend did it. So I don't really trust my opinion of it, but I mean, it's like a critically acclaimed, universally critically acclaimed movie. So
anyway, it was filmed in Chicago, and I have no connection to this movie and still think it's worth anyone's time. So
okay,
you're not being biased.
Okay, fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. I just had a really dumb smile on my face for the vast majority of it, which is not how I usually watch movies.
Sounds adorable. I think it was written in such a way where a really dumb smile on your face was the appropriate reaction. Like, for the most part, you weren't, like, laughing your ass off. It was mostly like, oh, what's the word I'm looking for? Relatable.
Low-key.
Happenings. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So as far as into, like, discussion points for this movie, like, the flaw of Kumail is his failure to be honest, especially in contrast to Emily, who, being a psychiatrist, not a therapist in training, she's really in touch with how she feels about any given scenario. And also Ray Romano's character, who's honest in spite of himself, like, he cheats on his wife and then immediately goes home and tells her about it, which, you know, is a good trait to have, that level of painful honesty. And it's something that Kumail certainly does not have. He picks it up as the movie goes on. Do you think that his failure to be honest is a result of, like, maintaining this double life with his parents? Or is he just an immature 20-something comic who's, like, scraping by and driving for Uber, and that's just a part of that phase of life? Like, what the cultural specificity, I think, and how it bleeds into his inner life is what I'm asking. Brian, thoughts?
Chelsea was talking to me about the temperature in the kids' room. So I heard something about Uber in there. I thought of, so. You're talking about
his failure to be honest.
Failure to be honest. It seemed genuine, like, to struggle with that telling your family. That's where we get into the whole culture clash aspect. Is that from that other movie we watched about Indian families, and we have some really close Indian friends that see it's such a tight family dynamic compared to what we have. So it seemed very genuine to me.
I think the combination of both hiding part of his lifestyle and not wanting to be as Pakistani as this Pakistani family, not that he's not wanting to be Pakistani, but he's more worldly than that. And also, but more so the, his relationship with Emily started with, you know, their 2-day rule and, you know, a ride. Neither of them, you know, at least led on that they had the intent of becoming of falling in love. They were just kind of there and then just grew and grew and grew. And as that lack of honesty happens, the fear is that it all comes crumbling down the day that, you know, you mention it. So by putting off the truth, it just makes it worse and worse.
Yeah, like to relate it to my own far less interesting life. Like, you know, there's a period in college or in late high school where you lie to your parents that you're going to church, and then eventually you tell them, I just don't do that anymore. And like Kumail does have that big moment. There were a lot less tears involved when it happened to me. It's just, I think he's just like, he values their opinion more and the stakes are higher for him. Like there was no concern about disowning on my part. I just really related to that part of it. You're not doing like your parents any favors by powdering their bums and letting them assume that you're living this perfect life that they have envisioned for you. And it's just something else to really appreciate about the Big Sick. And sticking with the culture clash aspect of it, I read an article from Good, which is maybe an online magazine. I don't know. I didn't look into it too much. Accusing it's just good.
You just have,
the website good. Is good.is. So whatever.
That's I'm not about looking as good as mediocremovie.club.
It's a way of the future. This article written by a Muslim woman accused works like The Big Sick and Master of None of lifting up non-practicing Muslims at the expense of practicing Muslims who are either in or perpetuating arranged marriages and judge their parents when they eat bacon or masturbate or whatever else. And to the extent that any practicing religious person is portrayed in movies, which I would argue is minimal. Like I had to really think about the last time I saw like a protagonist in a movie, like go to church or pray earnestly and not ironically. Like how fairly are Kumail's parents and the various female suitors and Islam itself? Like he was raised a Muslim. This is like his life to a certain extent, generated for fiction, of course, but is it treated fairly? Like could you be a practicing Muslim and also be a comedian as far as the movie is concerned? I don't know that you could.
Hold on. I don't think the Muslim thing is the arranged marriage. I think it's that portion of the world. I think that's a India Pakistani thing.
I think
they're two separate issues.
I think that is accurate. Part of their disappointment is that he is also not a practicing Muslim. Like there is that scene early in the movie where he tells him he's going down to pray, but he's just fucking around on his phone.
Right.
Two thoughts. First, I do think that they in this movie specifically was fair. To his family, they in your write-up you mentioned that like many Judd Apatow movies, it runs a little long. One scene that probably isn't necessary is him and his brother talking about his brother's perfect relationship. Mm-hmm. A lot of the scenes with there weren't really needed, but they were just to go and to support how much he cared about his family and was in fear of losing his family. So that arranged marriage worked out great for his brother. And it just wasn't going to work out for Kumail because that's not what Kumail's life was. My other thought was from this good.is article, which I did not read, sure. So I'm going off of your synopsis. Sure. I read it as them complaining that there aren't more movies, mainstream movies, about super practicing Muslims and I almost have to be the ugly American and say, well, I mean, that movie is not going to sell.
Yeah. And like, I don't necessarily want more practicing religious people in the world anyways. But as far as like representation is concerned, the quote that she pulled from the author of the article that she pulled from Kumail was like, Muslims also eat ice cream and go to amusement parks. And I want to show that side of Muslims in America instead of the side that is suspicious and may or may not be a terrorist. And the author replied with, well, Muslims, you know, they pray five times a day in America, and then they also go get ice cream. Like, it's not, like, he's very much a cultural Muslim, and that a person can be a cultural Catholic or a cafeteria Catholic and not actually do anything about their religion and claim that they're a Muslim. But a person can also be like a practicing Catholic and more or less do the exact same stuff, I think is the idea.
Okay, well, but is the interesting part of those people's story the fact that they're practicing Muslim or the rest of their day?
Yeah, I think the rest of their day as far as the movie is concerned.
There you go.
Yeah. Brian, anything to add about this whole thorny thicket?
I really like the Ravens movie that we watched that I nominated. What was that called?
Ravens movie?
The Ravens in England with their accidental terrorists. Four Lions. My bad. It's got a raven on the cover. That's all I can like think even about when you guys were talking.
Like the practicing law-abiding Muslim in that movie, super conservative, is like stuffing his wife in a closet with all of her female friends. So yeah, that guy's hardly a human being. So, all right. Yeah, great. Good pull.
There you go.
About the various Pakistani women that show up at Kumail's house. I do think that the movie treated them fairly. Like, they're also stuck in a bad situation where they're, like, submitting to their parents' authority.
Yeah, that was so awkward to watch that. Like, that was, like, you're getting into George Costanza uncomfortable when they would have to tell their stories.
Yes.
Yeah, and the girl that he actually kind of had some, you know, chemistry as a friendship type going with, and that he walked her home only to let her down and say this wasn't going to happen, and she kind of told him off. That was one of, you know, aside from the, you know, near-death experience, that was certainly one of the sadder moments in the movie. It was just her, you know, living out loud in the two-minute speech, the difficulty of maintaining this lifestyle.
Yeah, and to say one last thing about this good article, good, capital good, for the magazine. I feel like whenever movie critics, whatever, write what is kind of a takedown of a like critically beloved movie, they pull at the very thinnest of straws and just yank at them as much as they can. And she would have had to completely ignore that scene on the step where that Pakistani woman is like for her version of the Big Sick, where like she is having to go to all these single Pakistani men and somewhat humiliate herself for the sake of trying to get these people to date her, and it's all just so uncomfortable. And but she still keeps doing it, and she's still charming at each of these Kumails. It's really the only house that she's visiting. And I feel like the good Arthur, she talked about how it discounted those Pakistani women and was kind of laughing at them, and I just don't agree with that at all. So it was an interesting article from like that perspective of someone who, like you said, Riley, is just a long ways away from becoming like a major Hollywood release.
And yeah, and if the whole idea is we need films for representation for our people, this is a positive step in that direction. Yeah, it didn't go as far as you wanted to go for your representation, but it's better than you know, Riz Ahmed being cast as another terrorist.
Yeah. As awesome as he does play those terrorists in movies like Four Lions. So moving on, Brian, single out one of the many exceptional supporting performances in The Big Sick.
The mother? I don't know names. You're asking me to name names.
Sure, sure.
The mother.
Holly Hunter. We're talking about Emily's mother.
We should talk about how I don't think any of the supporting characters were bad. Like they were all fantastic.
Okay.
They were all awkward. The both sets of parents created awkwardness and uncomfortable. Like around the holidays, this is perfect. You go to family's house and you hear, you know, brothers, sisters, and their wives' husbands or your parents like just say things to each other, and it's just like condescending, and it's just weird and kind of rude, and it's uncomfortable for everyone. And I thought the American parents did a great job of that.
Riley?
Well, as a husband and a father, I'll single out the two dads. First, Kumail's dad, when he's you know, sending Kumail to New York and says that, you know, he's not allowed to give him a hug because his wife has forbidden it. That was pretty funny. But Ray Romano also as Emily's dad. People are always surprised when a comedic actor can do a bit of a dramatic turn.
We're going to talk about that later.
I thought he was so great because he was basically seemed to me like he was playing another version of himself. I mean, he became famous as just kind of the self-deprecating dorky dad comedian. And yeah, he was still self-deprecating dorky dad in this movie who just was in a, you know, a trying circumstance. And, you know, it's always the best performances are always the ones where you feel like they're playing versions of themselves.
Like, he knows he's the joke and he's totally fine with it, which is such an important dad role. like going deeper in his boarding cast, like his comedian friends, Kurt Braunohler, who played his roommate. I thought every scene he was in, I thought he was the funniest thing in the movie. He was like the taller, pasty white guy.
Because it's hard to play awful comic.
I believe that is probably true. Like, I mean, he's like a serious comic, and he's have to like purposefully, and like all the comics really, like Kumail has to dumb down him. So does Bo Burnham and Idie Bryant. I didn't know she was a comedian. I thought she was just like an SNL sketch person, but whatever, here nor there, I bought it.
I did want to feel bad because she makes me uncomfortable. She's just always got a look on her face that even on SNL, like she pulls me out of everything that she's in.
Like she does a lot of mugging, you think?
Yeah, I think it's like her eyes and like, I don't know, she kind of looks like the Debbie Downer character from SNL from years past. Yeah, she just pulls me out.
Like, yeah, you're just she pulls you away from the movie. Is that what you mean?
Even in SNL, she pulls me out of the skit that she's in. Like,
I agree.
I've not been a fan of hers. It's not her fault. It's just me and her just don't get along.
Okay, last thing on the Big Sick. I read a tweet, I want to say, from David Ehrlich, he of the fantastic year-end montages that everyone should go seek out immediately, Vimeo or YouTube, wherever they end up, that basically from Emily's perspective, this film is something of a horror show. Like, she falls into a coma after breaking up with her boyfriend, and then she wakes up to find her ex-boyfriend, like, has set up shop by her bed and has tricked her parents into thinking that they have a great relationship in some way. I don't know. Just thoughts about that.
He's giving her a bucket of ashes of women's pictures.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought they addressed that well by her not like immediately running back to him.
Yes. Like, and in fairness too, like when he first sees her after she comes out of it, she's very groggy and has no idea what's going on. And it's been a little bit since I've seen this. I didn't actually watch it this last month. I just wrote the review based on when I saw it in August. And feel like she scares him away. Like, she's very justifiably, because she is loopy as shit and just came out of a coma. But she like is like mean to him. Like, why are you here? That kind of thing. Is that right?
Right. I don't think it scares him away. She tells him the truth. And like, he shows up at her birthday party, or no, her coming home party, not birthday. And is all like trying to be sweet and get her back, and she's just basically tells him, "I don't want this right now."
Yeah,
and that was good.
I thought that was like in any other romantic comedy, the vast majority of other romantic comedies, like that's the end of the movie. They get together then, and like the camera spies them through the window, hugging, and then zooms out over the city, is in Chicago, blah blah fucking blah. But then, no, it's not that simple. The movie goes on for like another 15 minutes. Yeah, it's just a fun perspective. And for what it's worth, like in real life, they never actually broke up before she went into the coma. They just added that for like dramatic tension, which I think is totally fine. It doesn't make the movie any worse, I don't think.
Okay. Well, that horror show comment completely reminded me of the Sandra Bullock movie While You Were Sleeping.
Another coma romance. I have not seen it. I'm vaguely familiar.
She's like a subway teller. And has been obsessing from this dude who rides the same subway every morning to go to work. And he like gets mugged and pushed onto the tracks and is in a coma. And she pretends to be the girlfriend because she had been obsessing over him forever and ends up falling in love with his brother.
Okay. Sounds heartwarming.
Yeah.
So our next movie, Morris from America. This is Chad Hartigan's coming-of-age tale of an African-American boy and his father in the provincial Germany. It's primarily about the boy, but the father steals this movie. Craig Robinson plays Curtis as the dad, who is just a picture of loneliness at a time when his teenage son, Morris, played by Marquise Christmas, is just pulling further and further away from him. He doesn't want to play Jenga as much anymore. He doesn't want to get in the rap battles with his dad anymore. And it's just further isolating the dad, who is having as hard a time making friends as Morris is. And together they demonstrate just how difficult it is to adapt to a completely new environment with like this compounded wrinkle of the low-key racism that's present in Morris's youth group. As we're all childless or not yet the parents of teens, I'll assume that we related more to Morris while connecting more with Curtis. Like, we don't have teenage kids that are pulling away from us, but we've certainly all been teenagers, like in a new environment. Does Morris from America take you back to being a new part of an already established group, or is it just too much of a movie to really connect you to the characters in that way? Brian?
That's deep. My quick review from 12 months ago.
Just completely ignore my question.
is, just, look, I'm coming full circle here, or three-quarter circle, semi-circle. Is, I felt like there was a little bit too much tropiness to it, just like, I don't know, stereotyping. I mean, I work with kids on a daily basis who are new, and this felt like a little bit out of the box, like movie making, but it was a cute movie to watch, but I feel like it was more of a movie than anything that would ever actually happen.
It didn't quite ring true to you, just because you're around this kind of thing all the time.
Yeah, okay. 10 years of watching new kids move in.
Riley, how about you?
I watched this last week, and already I don't even remember the specific where. I know that while I was watching it, I was locked in. Like, it got me pretty early in terms of, you know, okay, I'm feeling this movie. I enjoy this movie. And there was at some point, I don't know if it was midway, three quarters of the way, I wouldn't say I checked out, but it felt like I was less connected to it. I still thought it was a very good movie, but I didn't have nearly the same relation to it that I think you're asking for.
Yeah, I think I might be highest on it just because I was repeatedly, I was this kid a lot growing up, like just not really knowing how to talk to people and going off by himself.
Were you the white kid in the black neighborhood?
Please? I was not. But as far as awkward teen stuff, transcends race. Like, everybody has that. The race stuff is on top of that in Morris from America, but everybody's got that in one sense or another. But speaking of the racism against Morris, I don't think Curtis really experiences it in the movie, other than the way people treat his son. Specifically, like the leadership, how they suspect Morris of always being a troublemaker, despite, you know, it's the older kids that are smoking the weed and doing whatever else they're doing. It's mostly, I thought, in how his crush, played by Lena Keller, as a slightly older girl, like, she uses him as a prop and a stereotype. But I don't think that girl ever really gets her comeuppance. Maybe that was on purpose. Maybe the movie just takes it too easy on her. Where do you guys land on that?
I had to rewind it when she asked him if he had a big dick. I was like, whoa, shit, is that what she said? Because I was, you know, looking at my phone or something, and I rewound it and played that back.
Yeah, that escalated quickly. Yes. I think so much of that is just her. Music
and you play basketball.
So much of that scene is just her sticking her thumb in her mom's eye at Morris's expense. And she kept... I get why Morris would keep wanting to hang out with this girl. That is totally understandable. But I really think the movie did not have a clear sense of coming across.
Well, her comeuppance is that she was 15 and was traveling with this dude's band, or this a DJ who's had to have been, what, 20?
Generous, yeah. Brian, any thoughts about the crush?
I don't remember anything about it.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, do what I can. Glad I can help here.
One of the many things that she does to Morris is that she forces him to rap at the club. Is this cruel, or is this like a necessary push that he needed? It all works out, but it certainly didn't have to. It could have easily gone in a different direction. I thought it was unforgivably cruel to just spring that on him.
I'm with you. It's Any forcing a teenager to do anything is mostly cruel.
Okay, said the teacher.
I thought, yeah, I thought it was assignments
every week.
They don't have to. I tell them they can take a
research is done. Homework is overrated.
It is. I give them very little homework. I say, just you don't even have to do it. Just get an A on the test, and you'll pass the class.
Right.
Of course, you're going to get an A if you don't do your homework. But whatever.
You're on the cutting edge.
Yeah, I do what I can.
I will fly in the face of that research. And say, at least for math, you have to do.
Here's where it actually is. When you have side tangent, big time here. If you have parents who are supportive at home, which is typically upper middle class and wealthy parents, homework is incredibly beneficial to advance a student's education. When you give homework to a kid who has no support at home, they're not going to do it. They can't find help. It's going to create frustration, and they'll do poorly in class.
And you can't, like, give some of the class homework and the rest of the class no homework.
You can. You're just going to get in trouble pretty quick.
I'm sorry, I don't give homework to the poor students.
There's the latest in math homework research.
Okay. So, Morris from America. This is Chad Hartigan's second film after a very tiny indie that was similarly themed called This Is Martin Bonner. But this is his first movie to feature a little bit of magical realism in the movie, with like the bobbing heads in the museum and like the shooting fountain behind Morris. And Pacha, I think, was his crush's name. It doesn't make any difference. Do those touches work in like a small movie like this, or are they distracting?
I wouldn't say that they don't work. I would just say that it just helps the viewer know what the kind of internal feeling that, you know, the character has. So the head bobbing in the museum to me told me that, you know, that he was feeling the music and, you know, having a good time checking out the museum and just kind of having a moment for himself.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I enjoyed both. They were like small enough to where it didn't make much of a difference. Like, there's the giant, ostentatious magical realism, like in 500 Days of Summer, where like the whole movie pauses for Joseph Gordon-Levitt to, you know, dance down the park to Hall & Oates. And I mean, let's not say that. I wouldn't say that's not a fun scene, but it's like I said, it's ostentatious. Whereas this is just a very small thing that doesn't require that kind of vast choreography. It's just, you know, a little bit of animation. Brian, just for further clarification, I feel like after Katrin gives what the fuck was his name? Morris her number.
I love when you forget names. It makes me feel so good about myself.
Fuck was his name? America?
No, that's not right. It's in the title.
What was the main character's name? Oh, man.
When, or Katrin or whatever, gives Morris her number, he like goes to the museum after and he's listening to music and he's popping his head, and then other people start popping their heads, and then the statues start popping their heads, and it goes from there.
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, okay, so nothing. Last thing on Morris from America. Craig Robinson is shortlisted for 2018 Supporting Actor Mediocrity for me this early out of the gate. I think he is one of the best movie dads in recent memory. We talked about Ray Romano with The Big Sick. Is there another like comic persona who just like thoroughly impressed you in a more serious role? Like I view Craig Robinson like completely differently now.
Comics will tell you that comedy is more difficult than drama. That
yeah.
Anybody can
do.
If you can do comedy, then you can do drama.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily the other way around.
I don't think Brad Pitt is like a. I don't think he has much of a sense of humor, despite how much weed he smokes. Or, I would love to see Daniel Day-Lewis in a comedy. I feel like that ship has sailed. But, or like him in a Tarantino movie would have been fantastic too. But just to see if he could do it, I'm sure he probably could have.
Yeah.
But I do think it. I do think you
I
see that.
I wouldn't want to see him in a Tarantino movie. He'd probably murder someone. He's a little too method.
That's definitely possible. He would probably say the N-word inappropriately to people on the street. It's a big part.
I was going to say, I don't have Robinson. I don't know his first name. Craig Robinson. I don't see this as like a drama role for him. This is not that far off of like his role in The Office is all I remember him for. This is a drama. It's him as a sarcastic dad. I think maybe he has a kid in real life, and this isn't that far from what you say to your punk kid.
I think primarily I'm thinking of his big speech at the end, which is like a 5-minute monologue, if not longer, where he is just playing it perfectly. Like he's about to cry, but this isn't for him. This isn't expunging his pain or sadness. This is about Morris. And if he cries, it ruins it. It becomes, I remember when my dad cried in front of me, and not, I remember my dad told me this story about him meeting up with my mother in Germany. And you can see that playing out on his face and like his voice just barely catching, and then he's swallowing that and getting back into a rhythm. And like he is funny in this movie, and he obviously has great comic timing, but there are also the scenes of him like just being lonely in his house by himself, or like when Morris walks away and he's reasonably upset about that. Like he recognizes that a phase is ending and a new phase is beginning. And yeah, it is both. It is both a comedic and a dramatic role, but I certainly don't think The Office like asked as much of him as Hartigan is asking here.
I'm looking real quickly online here. I don't know if he has kids, but he worked in a school system where helping kids learn music. I just don't see it as like, to me, a dramatic role is the whole show mainly is drama. I feel like that speech and most of what he's doing isn't far from the realm of fatherhood. That comes naturally once you have a couple kids, or a kid, or one, really.
All right, that's fair. Anything else on Morris from America before we head back to the 1990s?
Well, I was going to offer an answer to the bulleted question you had there. As I read your question on other personas who impressed, less so in terms of in a more serious role, but Chris Pratt, when he was cast for Guardians of the Galaxy, and everybody knew him as Andy from Parks and Rec. And then, you know, he got in shape, Guardians of the Galaxy blew up, and now he's one of the biggest stars in the world.
He tried to do some of the more dramatic stuff in Guardians of the Galaxy 2 with finding his dad.
He's still typecast to me.
I don't think he was good in those scenes. Like, he's tearing up a little bit, talking about his mom, and I don't think he's there yet. I haven't seen... Well, I saw half of Jurassic World, and he's playing a little straighter there, but that's still mostly like a comic rogue role.
Have you seen Passengers?
That is what I was going to bring up.
I would say he was fine in that. I think a better actor would have showed more loneliness that it would have been in that movie, but he was fine.
I don't think he's ever going to do better than Andy Dwyer. It was just so perfect for him. He needs to pack on like 75 pounds and go back to being like a comic lead. Like, I'm sure he's been paid enough. Like, Guardians of the Galaxy is going to run that string out. Eventually those characters will go away, he'll get recast. And then go back to what you're great at, Chris Pratt. And stick with what you're great at, Craig Robinson, which is anything you fucking want to do, because you can do it all. So our last movie is Dances with Wolves. It's Kevin Costner's famous best picture winning epic. It flips the typical Western culture clash dynamic by framing the Indians as the good guys and the whites as the bad guys. I don't know if this is the first movie to have done that. I think there's no way that's possible. But it's certainly the most successful movie, I think, of that era to have done this. Costner plays John Dunbar. He's the intermediary between the two societies. And he unmistakably puts his nickel down in favor of the nomadic Sioux lifestyle, especially in the wake of the bloody Civil War that he fought in and almost lost his foot. Arguably, Dances with Wolves is kicking off a trend for this kind of film with more humanized Native American characters, with soon-to-follow movies like far superior Last of the Mohicans and Shane's favorite movie Thunderheart and Geronimo, which I remember being horrified by when we watched it in like 7th or 6th grade. Just a lot of scalping in Geronimo. It was rough. Dances with Wolves is like Costner's big stamp as one of the biggest movie stars of the early 90s. It's going to follow this up with like Robin Hood, and then he's going to throw it all away with Waterworld and The Postman in like the mid-90s, here nor there. 25 years later, after the release of Dances with Wolves, is that acclaim imitation justified? Is this still a movie that holds up? Brian?
I had never seen it until we watched it.
That is shocking.
I okay, so like you say, he puts his, as John would say, he puts his nickel down. It takes him a long time to get there. I mean, it's a long movie, but it's not like he moves out there and it's like, oh, I love nature and I love the Native Americans. Like, it takes a while.
It was well earned.
Yeah, the expansiveness of the movie was quality. Like, they show the, you know, hundreds of thousands of buffalo and the prairie and some loneliness. The thing that got me about this movie that I don't understand is the monologues where he's reading from his journal.
Oh, we're going to talk about the monologues.
Okay. Other than that, I'm at the, like, really good movie. Tells a good story. But other than that part, those were distracting. Everything else I was 100% okay with until you convinced me otherwise.
Riley, how does Dances with Wolves hold up for you?
I had seen it a long time ago and, you know, knew it for what it was, the acclaim. But it had been, you know, it's old enough where I was young when I watched it. Watching it again and specifically on reading your review and how it relates to the fact that it beat Goodfellas for the Oscar, I would say that Oscar voters love an epic movie. And when an epic movie is done well, it's going to win. And there is no shame in losing to Dances with
Wolves. I don't know if I would go that far.
I think it's a good movie.
I want to say something about Goodfellas, and that doesn't apply to Dances with Wolves.
It's relevant.
Dances with Wolves had a good ending, or at least an ending of some sort, whether good or not. I felt like the last third, I've watched Goodfellas, I don't know, half a dozen times. The last like 30 to 45 minutes, I'm just done. Like I'm tired of watching it. The ending's great. I didn't feel that way with this one.
That was a complaint against, we're going to get off on a Scorsese tangent here. That was a complaint against Wolf of Wall Street too, that like you're just exhausted by the end of it. I feel like those movies are more or less the same length in an even 3 hours. I mean, I disagree. I think Goodfellas is in my top five of all time. I do not get tired of that movie. I think it like crescendos at the end. Like its best stuff is at the end, especially like the coked up day that he gets busted. And I mean, they're just structured very differently too. Like Goodfellas kind of peaks when he does get busted. And then the rest of it is just like very slow and not very slow, but like inevitable decay. Like this is the end. Things are going down. Is he going to escape with his life or not?
And I think Goodfellas peaks at the restaurant. And do you
with
think
the Billy Bats? Like, oh, yes. Oh, that's very early.
I know. And that's where I think it hits its high note. Not that the rest of the notes are low. I just feel like that's its sort of like peak of the movie. And it's time to start winding things down.
Like 30 minutes in. Let's wrap this shit up.
Just to bring it back to Wolves. Is the gap between Goodfellas and Dances with Wolves greater or less than the gap between Pulp Fiction and or Shawshank and Forrest Gump?
This is a great question. I would say yes to that. Yeah. Well, I don't know that I would. Like, there's Rocky over Taxi Driver and Network. I think that's the most egregious one. But I bet if I watched
Rocky's still an all-time movie, though. It's culturally iconic.
That's hard to disagree with. But if that is what it kind of is what the Oscars are for, here or there. As far as like Pulp Fiction and Forrest Gump and Shawshank, I think the gap between Shawshank and Pulp Fiction is pretty narrow. I think. Like if Shawshank had won instead of Pulp Fiction, I think that's acceptable. I like the gap is wider with Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction, I think, to where that is unacceptable. Like I bet I give Forrest Gump a C+ these days, as far as early to mid 90s epics, like that kind of thing, like long, very long drawn out stories of sweeping history. I cannot imagine that movie holds up for me, especially now when like baby boomers have so fucking ruined the country and that movie just a constant slob on their collective knobs. So I'm sure it would just offend me even more. But Dances with Wolves, as far as my opinion about whether or not, I mean, obviously Goodfellas, obviously Goodfellas is the better movie, but I don't think it's as egregious as I had thought before I hit. on this on Dances with the Wolves. I think like the first hour and a half is pretty great. Up to, I don't know exactly what part, maybe just after the buffalo hunt is when things really start to take a turn. And here we can talk about it. Like, there is a
form. When he picks up the Native American language in what seems like 30 seconds.
Oh, yes. There's a four-hour extended edition of Dances with the Wolves. Is this movie overlong as it is, or is that four-hour edition worth catching up with?
4 hours of this?
4 hours. There's another hour of Dances with the Wolves. Okay.
What is in the extra hour? Because
I have no idea. I couldn't find
it. For a movie that was made 27 years ago, it's still gorgeous.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So I can't imagine what it looked like in comparison to other movies at the time.
As far as packing more events into the extra hour?
Yeah, is it more pretty pictures or is it just filler dialogue?
I'm kind of curious to find out. I don't know that I would watch it.
Is it an extra six meetings where the two of them point at each other and and say, oh, do you want to go get some food? I mean, while you guys are complaining that all of a sudden he learned English or he learned the Sioux language, that part was a little drawn out. It not drawn out. It was needed to express, to get over the whole white savior thing, where all of a sudden he's the best member of the Sioux that
ever sued.
Ridiculous Six has.
Yeah,
the best Sioux that ever sued. That's beautiful. So to get over that, yes, there had to be the learning curve and the awkwardness.
I think the idea that this,
but that stuff was boring.
I mean, up to a point. I think once Stands with a Fist tags in as the interpreter, after the first like 10 minutes with her, once it shifts from her as an intermediary to her as a romantic partner, then things really go downhill, I think. I think just that romance is just less interesting than anything else happening in the movie. And as the movie goes on, there's more and more uninteresting stuff happening. Like, what utility do the Pawnee have in this movie? Like, could it lose 30 minutes by cutting everything with them out?
Right. Like, all of a sudden, it's just like all of a sudden the whole camp is leaving to go fight the Pawnee. But the viewer has no vested interest in that battle.
Maybe I don't
that think 4 hours is.
I don't feel like they're threatened when they go to fight them either.
Right. And then they're attacked.
A scout gone. Come and say, oh, here come the Pawnee.
Okay. Yeah. Simple as that.
No, like, but they left to go attack. And while they're gone attacking, the Pawnee attack them. Like, that was muddled.
So here's another question. Were the Sioux doing exactly what the Pawnee? Like, did Kicking Bird and Wind in His Hair go annihilate the old men and the women and children?
Exactly.
Because they all came back.
You're saying, is there a version of Dances with Wolves where John Dunbar is hanging out with the Pawnee and the Sioux are bastards?
And sure. He just got murdered by the Sioux.
Yeah. It just seems unnecessary. Like, the white people in Dances with Wolves are enough of a villain. And how they're portrayed, I think justifiably, between the Civil War and the Indian Wars that were coming. I don't have any problem with that. But the Pawnee are just extra. And the cherry on their uselessness is the hero shot of Stands with a Fist, like blasting one out of their teepee. But whatever.
Like you said, their romantic relationship was the worst part of the movie.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. So, Sean, you mentioned the white savior aspect that Dances with Wolves was in danger of engaging with. And there's also like the other side of that, which is noble savagery, in which membership in non-white society grants, in this case, the Sioux, like some kind of secret natural wisdom. And then it makes them idealized beings instead of actual complex humans that want more or less the same things as white people do. Does Dances with Wolves engage with either of that? I think we addressed the white savior already in that. Not really. He's just kind of a part of the tribe who happens to have a bunch of guns buried nearby. So that's his utility. But as far as like idealizing the Sioux, I don't think it does. I think like in their internal debates, they're justifiably suspicious. And there are easy alternatives to imagine where they just go out and kill him. based so, on.
Yeah, right, because they talk about, should we go out and kill him?
What I don't understand is, like, this is representative of the Sioux fighting the Pawnee. There had to be more. This is only, like, a few hundred people. It seems weird. I don't know enough about history to tell you, but it seems like a very small band. I just didn't. Just bringing up all the things that were distracting.
I don't have a, sense of, like, the size of Indian tribes in the 19th. Like, the 9th century, it is. Like, all the smallpox has already come through and everything else. So they're already, they've already been decimated, you know, dozens of times over.
Right.
So who knows? I mean, how big was that group? Like 100 people? 150?
More than that.
Maybe that's like carrying capacity for a nomadic tribe. That's worthy of more research. As like, that was very much my expectation going in, not having seen this movie in a while, was that it was going to be both of those things. Because, like, the easy rip on Avatar, which is 100% got its arms around both white saviors and noble savages, the knock on that was, like, you're just cutting out proper names and words from the Dances with the Wolves script or the Pocahontas script and subbing in Avatar nouns and words. But I don't think that was ever fair to Dances with the Wolves after this watching. So better than I expected it to be.
I've heard Costner on a few podcasts. He's in recent years kind of become semi-friends with Adam Carolla, so he's been on a few times. And he seems like, just in what he talks about in his interviews, he seems like he made so much money early on in his career that he's been able to be thoughtful in the products that he's attempted to produce on his end. Whereas, you know, Waterworld and The Postman ended up being shit. That's just because maybe he's not a great storyteller.
Yeah, but I think he just kind of lost control of his, like, creative vision, maybe. Like, his eyes got too big for his stomach with that kind of stuff. I don't know. I've never seen The Postman. The novelization of Waterworld when I was in high school is like a book report. It was okay.
I thought Waterworld was just fine. Everybody's so mad about that movie all the time.
It's a fun action movie.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's just, I think it was just like so expensive for the time period. Still for the time period, it was probably even more expensive than like super expensive superhero movies now with inflation and all that. So to return to the narration, is this excused through the journal being present and like all of his monologues he's presumably writing in his journal and he's just speaking in his mind's voice out loud? Or is this time wasted with Costner's voice, who is not a person that anyone would call a great actor?
You're separating him from his voice by that statement?
His voice is the one reading these, and some part of acting is line delivery.
Yeah, it was, again, I said it was monotone, and it was distractingly monotone.
Yeah, I don't think Costner's a great actor.
I think he was reading it in the form of how someone would be writing their diary. And I think the purpose of it was just to express the loneliness. You got a lot less of the diary dialogue the more he became Sue.
I do think that's true. But in general, like for me, narration either has to be tongue-in-cheek or unreliable to work in movies. Like here it's just so earnest and on the nose, and I don't know that it ever really adds anything. Like,
well, a lot
in
a
contrast
lot
to the loneliness, I don't think he's
specifically
lonely.
His log
or as a plot, like, point
a lot of the narration, at least early when he first arrived at the fort, was specifically like, oh, here's my log, there's nobody here, I'm gonna, you know, prepare the fort as if we're coming. You know, it was, you know, just kind of keeping detailed account of, you know, this soldier's log. And then it became more about the loneliness and, you know, loving, you know, nature. And but then it drifted away as he became Sue and he had people to experience life with.
I think it on that in that sense, I think like artistically, it works better as just like laying out a to-do list. Because that doesn't require any emotional inflection from Costner. But when it does, I do not think he is up to the task. And I would agree with Brian more so that the monotone of it and the odd emphases that he's putting on words deflates what he's trying to do there. It cost the movie some points from me.
Yeah, I think that the journal was important. I just don't know how it helped in any way.
Anything else on Dances with the Wolves before we move on to brief unifying themes?
I have a point before we do grades.
Go ahead.
Avengers Age of Ultron had a budget of $279 million. Captain America Civil War $250 million. Star Wars Force Awakens $200 million. Anyway, adjusted for inflation, Waterworld is at $283 million.
Wow. and that's not a terrible movie, but I think it didn't make half of that money back, not knowing off the top of my head.
Gross revenue, $264 million. But okay, so its cost was $175 million, though. So it brought in more than it cost.
Well, then I...
How much that Waterworld is. Revenue was overseas, though? How much of that was?
It doesn't matter.
I think it goes to the same pot.
Unless you get into like pass through tax credits. Let's talk
about that. This is like 95 too, when like foreign markets aren't as significant. I would wager like 90% of that, if not more, was in. I doubt the French went nuts for Waterworld. So grades on these three movies, in order, I went A- and then 2 Bs from Wars from America and Dances with Wolves.
Wait, we got to stop because you're so wrong. Domestic was 1/3 and foreign was 2/3. Worldwide, it brought in 264. Domestic, 88. Foreign, 175 million. There you go. I feel like this should be my role on every pod is to just do the numbers.
See, that's why it's a failure because people only care about what happened here.
Right. Yeah. But overseas, that's a huge hit. Gee, Merry Christmas. $175 million?
Riley, your grades for the Culture Clash trio?
As I said, A+ on Big Sick. I would say the first half of Morse of America, I was at A-, and then I think I probably ended with B+. It was still a good movie. Dances with Wolves, B+. Maybe A-, but B+, I think.
Brian?
I'm at B+ for Big Sick, B- for Morris in America, and I'll probably go B or B+ for Dances with Wolves. This is a quality set. Way to go, dear leader.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I feel weird having the same grade for Morris and Dances with Wolves, but I feel like you're grading the grading scale is a little different based on a different type of movie.
Sure.
I don't think you can grade them the same way.
I think Morris maintains a solid level throughout without ever necessarily attaining like the sustained highs necessary to break into the A's, whereas Dances with the Wolves on occasion does break into that stratosphere, but it's low, fairly significant as the movie goes on. So they both even out, in my mind, to a B. In that I really enjoyed both movies, but yeah, very different. Real quick wrap up, as far as unifying themes, like in each of these three films, characters are making choices, but there's not really a choice presented as far as which culture that is clashing is preferred. Any of these films have been improved if the losing sides, being Islam in Germany and America, were more enticing for the protagonists.
So you're saying that America lost Dances with Wolves and Islam lost the Big Six? Is that what you're suggesting?
In the battle for the protagonists, like Kumail is between secularism and Islam, and Morris is between like America and Germany.
I still think you're mixing Islam with the region. Like I looked at it as a regional thing, a religious thing.
There are Hindu people in India that do arrange marriages, sure. But it is a part of like the whole Middle Eastern culture, I feel like, as well. Like from Morocco to Pakistan. That whole strip.
I don't know.
I don't know anyone from there really.
And the Islam, and as we said, there are Islamic aspects as well that Kumail is flaunting. But as like secularism and religiosity, then, if that's any better, or Germany and America with Morris, or America and the Sioux with Dunbar, there's not really a choice to be made. I'm saying, like, Kumail can't really be with Emily, and well, I mean, it all worked out for him in real life, and as the movie ended as well, like there was a sense of reconciliation, certainly, but he's not going to change anything about his life. He's not going to be more Islamic or conservative going forward.
Right.
So he's making a choice, and his parents are going along with it. And the Americans are going to continue to hunt for John Dunbar, and he's going to stick to Sioux ways as best he can. He's also going to try and spread the word about how these people are not enemies. And it's less strange. Like, Morris isn't going anywhere. He's going to learn German more, and he's going to assimilate a little more, but he's still going to have that American influence just because he spent so much of his life there, so much of his formative years. So the question
he
is...
He should hire Mr. Dunbar to teach him a foreign language. He'll pick it up so fast.
He should get Stands with a Fist across the Atlantic.
That's right. Stands with a Fist. She's the teacher. That's right.
So the question is, like, these are lopsided battles. Are the movies dramatically improved if they weren't so lopsided?
So you're saying... At least for Morris, let me ask, because your lopsidedness is confusing to me. If he were to be happier to be German, or happier about being in Germany?
I think there it's assimilation versus isolation. Like, the red-haired bully who plays the piccolo or whatever he plays,
he... That was the weird. That was weird. Like no cool kid plays the flute.
He earnestly, I think, at the youth group, asks Morris to play basketball, and Morris gives him the cold shoulder, and the bully, sensing like the power dynamic between the two of them, like, this, all right, this just turned into a fun project for me where I get to shit on this American kid. If Morris had played basketball with them, I feel like everything would have been fine, and he chooses not to. Is that just my interpretation of that scene, or did you see it differently?
No, I felt the same way. He was gonna let him play basketball, and you know, maybe he wanted him to be on his team because he was black and assumed that he would be a good player. I don't know,
or maybe
he was really just him to play.
Yeah. Yes.
Now him deciding, oh, you're a rapper, you must be MC Big Mac because you're a chubby kid. You know, that was mean. Yeah. But he had already turned that page.
Absolutely. So, to reframe the battles that are happening within the protagonist, America and the Sioux for Dunbar, 100%, that's what it is. Assimilation or isolation with Morris, and secularism versus conservatism for Kumail. Conservatism isn't really a choice for him. Assimilation isn't really a choice for Morris, and America isn't really a choice for Dunbar. If the opposite was more enticing, are these movies improved?
I don't know. I think the only way Dunbar has America as a choice is if he wasn't already trying to commit suicide via Confederate forces. He was giving up on America. Not Absolutely. America. He just wanted to be done with his life. So he wanted
I
to
think America
here
too.
And like I'm done.
He wanted to go out there beyond the stated reason, you know, just to be away from people. He's not so much lonely when he gets out there, like he's isolated. But that's what he wants to be. He just wants to be out in the wilderness with his wolf and his horse. And that's that.
But all of his journal entries are about, like, manning the station until people come. Like, it's he never
he's still in the army. Like, that's
his job.
But he never expresses, like, a desire to be alone.
When he's with Timmons, his guide, he says this would be a perfect trip if not for him.
Well, that's because he doesn't like how awful he is.
Yeah, that guy sucked.
Yeah, that guy did suck, but it would be a perfect trip if he was alone is another way to read that sentence.
Mm.
And that's how I read it.
Can I ask about a character we didn't talk about?
Mm-hmm.
The person who he met with before being sent out to the last post who pissed his pants and then shot his brains out?
Sure. Yeah, that was weird.
What was up with that guy?
I think that was just Costner wanting to communicate like a medieval quest type aspect to his journey. Like he's going out to search for the Holy Grail type of thing. Or maybe like a Don Quixote type of motif. I don't know. I like that scene just because that guy is so fucking nuts. But it's a good question. I could see that really breaking the movie for some people. Like, what has this movie where... This movie that opened on bloody aprons and boot piles that used to have feet in them, what is it turning into with this comical major who, yes, pisses himself and speaks like he's a knight at Sir Arthur's table?
The only thing I can think of is it's trying to show the desperation and awfulness of the Civil War. And he's just done. He's out.
See, I was thinking less of the Civil War and more of the isolationism of being out west.
Yeah, I don't know.
It says his name is Major Fambro.
I'll add him to the supporting actor.
Right underneath, when I click on him, it says plot explanation. What was the deal with the crazy major?
Okay, so that first question was a bit of a dud. The second question and final question for this episode. If none of these films do White Saviors and Noble Savagery, and Dances with Wolves is really the only one where that was a possibility in the first place, what are some others that do engage in those kind of things?
You got to give me some examples. My goodness.
Well, Ridiculous Six, I think. But, you know, that was supposed to be a stupid movie. But if you're wanting a movie that was not striving for moronicness.
Fuck the Ridiculous
Six. I'm not as good at the Westerns as many others are. But, you know, I'd say any John Wayne movie that also has Indians in it probably falls into this category because John Wayne's awful. Last Samurai, for sure.
I was thinking of The Last Samurai. That's the example that I had in my pocket. I really like The Last Samurai. I think it's exceptionally acted, and like the action is pretty great in that movie. But it's both of those things. Like, the samurai were brutal people who were living a feudalistic society that needed to be altered. And yeah, great, tended to cherry blossoms and were mindful of aesthetics, but, you know, not fantastic. Feudalism is something that does not need to stick around in any way, shape, or form. But then the other half of that too, with Tom Cruise entering a culture in which, like, sushi chefs have to spend 5 years molding rice before they can move on to the next step into whatever being a sushi chef entails. And he just is a master swordsman leading charges and all this other shit after a few months. Like, yeah, it's egregious. As much as I like that movie, like, it's pretty much fatally flawed.
I haven't seen that one. We talked last week about, like, Wind River. I feel like I'm just...
We did.
It fits the mold. I don't think they meant for that to happen, but it's just, it fits.
That movie is coming up. I review Hopper, and I know that it didn't review fantastically, and I wonder
who says it doesn't review fantastically.
I read a lot of middling, or not read. I saw a lot of middling. 87%
on Rotten Tomatoes.
I mean, there's a wide. I feel like most critics were like in the B-C+ range for it. At least the critics that I pay attention to, and I'll be interested to find out why that is, because I didn't, especially if it's about these like more PC. Because I did not get that from Wind River at all. So that'll do us for the Culture Trio. Our next trio, we're playing catch-up for 2017 in the dead period of January. And we're going to be watching Split, the M. Night Shyamalan movie, which I believe is on HBO now.
Ooh, I haven't seen that yet. I'm excited.
Yeah, I've been wanting to watch it. That's the main reason I picked that group. Damn.
I fucked it all up. I presented three options for 2017 catch-up movies, one wide release, one indie, and one foreign. And I thought I seeded the wide release with enough potential stinkers to keep people from voting for it, and it won running away. So I made a mistake there. But these aren't – I haven't seen one of these movies yet, but it's not going to be the worst round. I mean, Denzel Washington really shocked us with its averageness.
that was unmotivating, to say the least.
Fair. Totally fair. So we're watching Split.
It was a bad month, and I had seen two of the movies already.
Yeah. Not my best work. So Split on HBO Now, The Great Wall, speaking of white saviors, potentially.
Oh, yeah.
on HBO Now.
Oh, gosh. That's
and Megan Levy on Amazon Prime. Kate Mara.
That was the one of the three that I really don't want to watch.
I thought The Great – I've seen The Great Wall. I feel like I've talked about The Great Wall on a podcast already.
You've talked it up unnecessarily.
It was so dumb, but it's also very brightly colored, and there's a lot happening on the screen. So it was fun enough to watch, but we'll be talking about
that's a fair assessment
in the coming month. Check us out on the internet at MuticaMovie.club. Like us on Facebook, Mutica Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter, Mutica Movical. If you are doing some late Christmas shopping, if you are lazy as shit like we are, like who knows when this episode is going to get edited and put out to the public. Might be tonight. It might be now. We'll find out.
Next Christmas.
Might put it deep in my pocket and just whip it out whenever I need it. If you know your parents or your extended family or whoever that you buy presents for is super pissed off at you for procrastinating, go to our website, click on our Amazon link, and do your shopping through there. We get a little kickback, doesn't cost you anything, and helps us to keep everything running with our high capacity iTunes feed.
Even if you're not procrastinators and you just got gift cards for Christmas,
I think that still kicks back to us.
No, you have to actually pay.
It has to be cat. It was a good thought, Riley. Speaking of iTunes, reviews on there help us reach more people, and we would appreciate it if you left some of those. That'll do us for this episode of the Munich Movie Club podcast. We have a packed January coming up with the aforementioned reviews. We'll be doing a podcast about those eventually at the end of the month. But in the meantime, we're going to be talking about the classic HBO series, classic 10 years old HBO series Rome. The Ambulators getting back together to discuss that, two seasons worth. So shorter than Deadwood. We'll get through it a little faster, I think. And just
that
because
series even good?
I think so.
Okay.
And being 2018 in a few days, we're also going to be talking about the best of 2017 in movies and TV. We're going to be doing two episodes each on those, the best and the worst. Different casts, get a lot of different shows and recommendations out there. It'll be fun. So something to look forward to in your iTunes feed or wherever you listen to the Mutica Movie Club podcast. Thank you for joining me tonight, guys.
It's been a pleasure.
Hey, have a good night.